giving me the opportunity to come to this great place. I'm here for the first time, and it's great to meet all these people interested in such fundamental, interesting physics. And let me at this stage also thank Bhaskaran for inviting me here and letting me speak about some research of ours that we've been pursuing recently. So I will try to give you a sort of introduction to a field of superconductivity that arose decades ago, but that had a significant revival in the last years, which could be labeled topological superconductivity. And we'll see how that goes and in which sense new materials may arise or may have appeared lately that may link to this type of physics that we can see in actual condensed matter materials. To begin with, as a condensed matter physicist, let me shortly tell you of what are the fields that I'm mostly interested in these days. In particular, I'm thinking about whatever wherever quantum corrections and quantum physics yield interesting many-body phenomena, such as you can find in frustrated magnetism. You see the Kagome plaquette here. I'm also interested in superconductivity and different phenomena found therein, as well as spin orbit phenomena that got more attention lately due to the emergence of topological insulators, for example, or also strongly coupled models where the orbital degrees of freedom play an important role. And of course, another hallmark field to understand unconventional physics in quantum many-body physics is the quantum Hall effect that I've also been considering. The angle at which I look at these systems is shared by the labeling of topological quantum phases in the sense that I'm interested in how topological aspects play a role in all of these different systems. So actually, in the last decades, a lot of fundamental accomplishments have been done on this. And I want to use the word topological quantum phases here for the time being as any non-local quantity that is characterizing a material and that is actually that helps us to understand the phenomena associated with this condensed matter system. In this talk, as you've seen before from the title, I'll probably exclusively single out one field where I want to look at topological phenomena appearing, which will be the superconductors, and I will devote your and my attention now to the question of how do we find topological superconductivity. So this will be the main emphasis of this talk. And let me shortly begin by mentioning my collaborators. So the large portion of this work and also the unpublished work that is upcoming within the next 2 weeks has been done in collaboration with the group by Werner Hanke in Würzburg. And I want to name the great PhD students in Würzburg, to begin with Christian Platt and Maximilian Kiesel. And I also want to mention the helpful collaboration with Dima Abanin, who is currently in Harvard and supposedly will be part of this great institute as well soon. So at this stage, I also want to thank for the great discussions I had over the last months on these topics. And to begin with, I thank Bhaskaran for a lot of interesting insights to that matter, and also the theory and experimental group at Stanford, which has greatly helped me to accomplish a better understanding of these systems. In particular, Steve Kivelson, Sri Raghu, Shao Yang, Su Sheng, and from the experimental side, James Analytis and Ian Fisher. So the outline of the talk is as follows. I will first define what I mean by topological superconductivity. And as we will see, there are different manifestations of topological properties arising in the field of superconductors. And then I'll shortly introduce the method by which we access the type of topological superconductivity that I'm going to introduce to you. And as soon as we've set up the theoretical body of approaches that we use to treat these systems, I'll particularly discuss two systems in which we believe that unconventional topological superconductivity can be found, which is graphene on the one hand and cobaltates on the other. So graphene is published already, and you can look at it at the archive, and the work on the cobaltates will appear very soon. So let us begin with topological superconductivity and what I mean by this. So let's first review the formalism that we will employ to access superconducting systems, which will basically a grad course review of how you would naturally treat superconductors in a mean field fashion. This is, of course, BCS mean field theory, which is by far transcending the microscopic mechanism that was originally the basis of establishing the BCS theory. So we will keep the part of the description, but we'll think of different microscopic mechanisms that drive the superconductivity. So what you're dealing with here is some band structure labeled by this bilinear. These are fermionic creation and annihilation operators of spin sigma and momentum k. And this is the mean field parameter of this mean field theory. This is the gap function, or yeah, different. There are different expressions in the literature, but I'll stick to the expression gap function. So there's the gap function by which you approximate the interaction part of the Hamiltonian to become a bilinear and fermionic operators again. And what you see here is that this pairing field breaks U1 symmetry, which is the essence of superconductivity. So this pairing field in the superconducting phase becomes a finite expectation value, as you can see here. So this would be what we think about it. It's broken up to Z2 because you still have the pi invariance by doing a gate transformation to e to the I pi, but that's details. The main insight that was given by Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer basically is all incorporated in this wave function. So this is the wave functional ansatz for them to come up with describing a superconductor. And what you see here is that you just fill the vacuum by superconducting pairs. So you see they are time-reversed pairs of electrons, and with a certain probability, a pair of momentum k. I'm particularizing at the moment here to the singlet channel. So with a certain probability, this one of the Cooper pairs is populated or unpopulated. So this is just a superposition of Cooper pairs. This is not yet the insight. The main insight is the absence of a phase-dependent term in this description. This is basically saying that we superimpose different Cooper pairs with the same phase. So it's a phase-coherent superposition of Cooper pairs. And this is the essence of BCS theory. This is telling you that you're breaking the symmetry and getting a phase-coherent new ground state, which is incorporating this superconducting phenomenology. So from there, that's just the wave function. I mean, the problem, okay, sure you will construct. Oh, so you could think of, it's a wave function, so we're not constrained to be. So if I introduce some phase factor here that is k-dependent, this would be perfectly fine. This is even more suggestive if you are thinking of this wave function in a real space picture. You can think of these Cooper pairs having relative phases against each other, but then you would not have a phase-coherent superconducting ground state. Then you would lose all of these appreciable properties that all these Cooper pairs act as one single ground state, which is describing the absence of resistivity in the system.
So you're saying
BK,
the phase of
BK
does not depend on
k. Yeah, if I were putting some e to the I phi of k in here, this would basically manifest the reduced amount of phase coherence in the system. And this would, at some stage, lose the superconducting phenomenology, which is at the essence of the whole approach.
But for good case for
yes. That's your question. Yes.
No, I was just confused because the notation doesn't indicate what you said.
Oh, yeah. Sorry for that. So the quasi-particle description coming from there, this is the basic outcome of any mean field theory. That's the advantage that you get. So by Bogoyubov transformation, you can make this become diagonal in a new set of creation operators creation and annihilation operators that you would call the quasi-particle operators. And then you would have some effectively non-interacting system with a dispersion relation. And as you can see here, the energy as a function of k is composed both out of the non-interacting band structure part and the gap function coming from the pairing part. And this would be the dispersion relation that you would usually see. So when you have an S wave, you see explicitly that this quasi-particle spectrum is gapped, for example. And what is very interesting is already at this stage, while this mean field theory looks completely innocent, we already see that these quasi-particle excitations have an effective charge that depends on k. So as you can see here, the quasi-particle charge of these Bogoyubov quasi-particles depends on the dispersion relation over E of k. And as you can see here, as soon as we go to the long wavelength limit, the charge would effectively be zero. So in the long wavelength limit, the charge of a quasiparticle in a superconductor is zero. This is already hinting interesting features here, basically saying that we already at the stage of this mean field description, we see a fractionalization of quantum numbers in the superconductor. So this is already leading us to a very introductory perspective on why superconductors may already be perceived topological from a very fundamental level of perception. So let us...
I'm quoting it.
But it's a two-line thing to derive.
Okay.
So you can... The main thing why I'm saying this here is that already at this very elementary level of mean field theory, you see a mean field theory that is incorporating fractionalization of quantum numbers already. This is very easy to understand. In a superconductor, the charge is located on the edge because it's fully screened. It's a perfect diamagnet. So as a consequence, in a short wavelength description, you may still have admixtures, but in the long wavelength description, you should not be able to see the charge of the excitation anymore. And this is just given by this mean field description. Now you're asking, can we detect that charge in a superconductor? That's a totally different story, because usually as soon as you experimentally access the detection of a charge, you're killing the order parameter at the point where you detect it. So I'm just saying that at the level of an effective description that is giving you the first hint what we're dealing with. So
can I just ask?
Of course.
Okay, so some people claim that superconductivity is topological order.
Could you say that?
Superconductivity is topological order, right?
Yeah. So let me come to this in a second.
Okay.
Let me come to this in a second. So yeah, let me first answer what is actually topological about superconductivity. And in the last years, a lot of different perspectives have come up that basically led people to state superconductors to be topological. Let me very shortly review the different angles. So one angle was given by a very nice work by Shivaji Sondi and Hans Hansson and Vadim Ovanesyan, basically pointing out, among other things, pointing out one thing that I already mentioned, basically mentioning this fractionalization of quantum numbers that may be interpreted as reminiscent of a topological phase. And moreover, elaborating a little bit, this is a well-known fact, but they nicely elaborate on that. So their earlier works also stating this result. But what is interesting here is that they very accessibly elaborate on the following fact. So think of this pairing field in real space. And let's think of this pairing field and assume that the superconductor is not topologically ordered in whatever sense. Then when you have no topological order, when you have a topologically trivial system, you may think that you should be able to write down this order parameter in a local fashion. So a local order parameter would be the usual description that we would adopt for Ginzburg-Landau description of very usual breaking of symmetries. However, immediately, when you're realizing that this is a charged superfluid that we're talking about, this expression manifestly would not be gauge invariant. So if you wanted to make this superconducting pairing field become gauge invariant, the natural modification to the theory is to basically put a Dirac string on it. And this effectively would make this order parameter become non-local. This is sort of the punchline. Of course, we can fix a gauge in which it looks local, but I'm just saying that from a gauge invariance perspective, the order parameter of a superconductor is non-local. And this is the punchline of their paper. That's one perspective by which you may be tempted to say that superconductors generically share aspects of a topological phase. Let me stress, they share aspects. I would say there are details that do not match. For example, the superconductor does not show topological degeneracy, for example. So when you make the statement that an S-wave superconductor is topologically ordered, you would normally say that topological order comes along with some topological degeneracy. There is none.
That you can associate with flux sweep, much like the quantum hole.
Yeah, as soon as you approach the long wavelength field theory that they employ in their paper,
right,
you basically end up with transcendence type field theories. And there you can elaborate on this fact, but the statement for S wave would still be there. Following the arguments, it should be a topologically ordered phase, but the S wave in whatever angle you look at it, should not have topological degeneracy. I'm just saying this is a detail. I think what the main accomplishment of this perspective is that we should always keep in mind that superconductivity is already an involved state of matter from the beginning. So and something that led to later, so let us talk in more detail later. So another angle is that we can actually use superconductors to generate a to generate a topological non-trivial phase. So this is not to say that the superconductor necessarily has to be topologically non-trivial. It's just saying it gives us a way to stabilize, in this case, interface phases that share topological properties. And one interesting proposal came up by Fu and Kane in 2009 and was followed up immediately in also even more experimentally accessible systems by Shankar Dasamra's group around J. Deep Zhao and Roman Luchin, as well as Jason Alicea and Irvine. And this is a different perspective of how a superconductor could help us to stabilize a topological phase. This is another angle, how topology comes into play in association with superconductors. Even a third way is that we've seen that this band structure enters this mean field description of superconductors. For the time being, we had assumed that this band structure is trivial from a topological point of view. But since the rise of topological insulators, we know that we can actually think of band structures that are non-trivial from a topological perspective, having a non-trivial Chern number, for example. So there have been latest suggestions of 3D topological superconductors, and there you see the coined expression, where the main source for the superconductivity to arise is intimately linked to the fact that this band structure is topologically non-trivial.
The charged superfluid, which is topological but not the uncharged one? No, I'm saying, of course, because for the uncharged one, I can define a local order parameter. The uncharged one.
Yeah, that's why I'm stressing charged superfluids. But this doesn't necessarily mean that superfluid helium is topologically trivial. Let me come to the third point, how topology can arise in this, in a superfluid in general. Yeah.
Just a question on sort of the same point. The top line, you say there's a non-local order parameter. That's referring to the string, I guess.
Yes.
But wouldn't you be able to make that same statement about any charged field? Any charged field in itself is not gauge invariant. You can attach a string to it and make it gauge invariant.
I fully agree with you. But this is a fundamental statement saying that my order parameter, to make my order parameter invariant under all the symmetries that are available in the system, if I want to do that, I would have to formalize it in a non-local fashion.
Yeah, but it's nothing special about superconductor. Any charge field would have
of course. The presence of the gauge field makes it facing this property. Of course, I agree with you.
But isn't that a trivial statement?
So he's trying to put it in the box, a broken symmetry.
I mean, isn't the topological superconductor going to be something different?
Of
course. Because this is kind of a trivial statement about any...
I don't think it's trivial. For example,
would you say the electroweak vacuum is topologically ordered in the Higgs breaking of weak field? Is that topological because it has a charged order parameter? We don't normally think of that as a charge, as a topological condensate. It's a classical.
Yeah, condensate. I would have to think about this more carefully. But for the case of the superconductors, this is just one angle at which you see that there are aspects of the topological phase arising. Fractionalization of excitations, this issue of how to define the order parameter in such a way that it shares all the reminiscent symmetries of the system. So this just gives an overall perspective on superconductors as being involved from the perspective of topology.
If we just take a spontaneously broken gauge theory,
yes,
and you take the limit where the gauge coupling goes to zero, it becomes classical. And so the condensate of the field is a classical object. So it's very hard to see in that some complicated quantum topological order. I think
we're going some direction that we should postpone to some later stage. But I would disagree with the statement that a gauge symmetry can be spontaneously broken. So in my language as a condensed matter theorist, a gauge symmetry is a matter of description. So the description can always be, so there's a shorthand notation for thinking of superconductors as a spontaneously broken gauge theory, but this is, I think, slightly misleading, because the U1 that is broken here is not the local U1. You can reformalize the system in a way that what is broken is the global U1 that is related to charge conservation.
Sure.
That's the one. But when you say...
No, I think everyone agrees with those words. But,
yeah.
But from a practical point of view, when you have a spontaneously broken gauge theory and you form a classical vacuum and you do calculations around it, that is a perfectly legitimate way to treat it if the coupling is weak. So these issues of principle don't actually play any role in practical calculations.
Yeah, it will definitely be interesting to reconcile.
It's important in a finite volume. It's important in a finite volume, but in the infinite volume limit, you can just treat it as spontaneously broken classical field.
Yeah. So it would be interesting to catch up on that later on.
Okay.
So what Nandini was bringing up, I think, is stating that she would be thinking of this being a trivial topological aspect of superconductors,
yep.
while probably what she's thinking of as a non-trivial aspect of a topologically non-trivial aspect of superconductors is if the pairing function delta of k is by itself constituting a non-trivial topological phase. And apparently this was probably the first one of these notions of topology in superconductors that has been figured out. And the earliest reference I could find, maybe Vesper, you can give me an earlier even. The earliest reference where this comes up is by Volovic from 1976. So what I will be focus our attention in the remainder part of the talk is we'll be thinking about topological superconductors in the sense that it is connected to the superconducting gap function. But throughout these fields in the literature, you will see the phrasing topological superconductor coming up. So I think it is good to know at which angle we look at this word topological superconductor. So let me start with the probably best established example of a topological superconductor from theory point of view. Which goes under the name P plus IP superconductor. What do people think about this? I've picked a special P wave solution. Let me not get into the discussion of what different solution we could have. But what you see is essentially it's an effectively 2D way of writing the order parameter, the gap function that we talked about before, in the following fashion. So we have a kx plus minus iky, and plus minus, one of them is fixing either a left chiral or a right chiral superconductor. What this connects to is having a Cooper pair with a chirality, either left-handed or right-handed chirality. And this spin triplet pairing, it is spin triplet pairing because the orbital angular momentum associated with the Cooper pair is odd, is one. So when the total wave function should be fermionic, then you want to have a symmetric spin function part of the system, which is why it's a spin triplet pairing. And this time of order parameter breaks time reversal t, as you've seen, we send I to minus I, and breaks p in 2D because parity in 2D would be sending x to minus x or y to minus y, and as a consequence, it would similarly break this symmetry, so it breaks p and t. And why people were so interested in that is that it is bulk gap, it's a bulk gap system, but at the same time, it should give rise to an edge mode that could be detected as Qantas thermal Hall conductivity within the bulk gap of the system. So if you imagine an ideal experiment, where you could measure the thermal Hall conductivity at energy scales below the bulk gap, then you should still see this edge mode arising and contributing to this experimentally accessible quantity. And this had been suggested, and Catherine Kellen is also in the audience that has done a lot of interesting work on this field. It was suggested to be realized in the ruthenates, and to be more exact, in strontium ruthenate, but I think it's fair to say it's still an open problem to fix details there and actually to connect experimental notions with theoretical predictions. Why I'm bringing this up as the first example is that from a conceptual point of view, I think this is one of the topological superconductors that we understand best. Why do I say that? When we look at a real space BCS wave function, the wave function I showed you before in momentum space, and fix the number of particles, then it has the manifest form of an anti-symmetrization over pairs of electrons. So these are the coordinates of the electrons in the ground state. And this is supposed to denote an anti-symmetrization over pairs. And then we have one pair function that only depends on the distance between the particles. And it should incorporate the fact that the electrons want to pair, which means that as a consequence, this function should have an increased probability to make the electrons close to each other and less probability to be them far away from each other. So of course there will be cutoffs to the system this singularity can be regularized. So for r equals zero, that's not the issue here. But this function here that I just explained to you in a slightly complicated but at least microscopically connected fashion is something that people would call the Pfaffian. And the Pfaffian wave function was the prototype wave function in which the notions of non-abelian statistics, for example, has come up by seminal works by Greg Moore and Nick Reed. And this Pfaffian wave function gives us a wonderful angle of seeing how topology helps us to connect fields of condensed matter theory that you would otherwise not believe to be connected. So the first way it came up in the context of condensed matter theory was the 5/2 quantum Hall state and the basic understanding of this non-trivial physics contained in this Pfaffian wave function was done by Moore and Reed. And to realize that this has something to do with the 5/2 state was accomplished by Martin Greiter, Xiaogang Wen, and Frank Wilczek in the same year. But now that we know that this Pfaffian shows up here, we've seen that it also shows up in the P plus IP superconductor along this argument. And to put this on way more conceptual and idealized rigorous footing was accomplished in a great paper by Nick Reed and Dimitri Green around 2000. And lately, we could also show that, you see, we have a quantum Hall system that has the same Gronsted wave function. Now we have a superconductor that has the same Gronsted wave function. And we can even write down a spin one spin liquid that has this wave function. So you see that although the elementary excitations are completely different in these systems, as soon as you're fixing sort of the topology of these systems, you're, in certain cases, you're even able to constrain the shape of the Gronsted wave function written in the respective excitation profiles. So let me give you the most, I think, by far the most intuitive way to understand non-abelian statistics in this Pfaffian wave function. And out of this triangle, let me pick the superconductor, because this talk is supposed to be about superconductivity. So this is a fantastic work by Dima Ivanov from 2001. And basically what people do to resolve this non-abelian character of a P plus IP superconductor is they look at the spectrum of a vortex core. A vortex core is nothing but a defect in the superconducting fluid. So you thread some magnetic field through the superconductor, and at the point where the superconducting order parameter drops to zero, we have this defect, and then you can actually ask, what is the excitation spectrum in this defect? So when you do this, you can rephrase this problem in a Bogoyubov-Degen Hamiltonian that looks like this. So you're familiar from that from Luttinger theory also. So you're basically assuming that this is bilinear and gamma. So when it's a bilinear and gamma, then the commutator should give E. So we look for solutions of this annihilation operator gamma. But when we look for solutions for this annihilation operator gamma, at the same time, we can rephrase this problem just by adjunction and rephrase it as a solution for the creation operator gamma. So you see an emergent particle Hall symmetry in the Bogoyubov-Degen spectrum of vortex cores. It's an emergent symmetry. It doesn't necessarily have to be shared by the fundamental system. So what the main punchline here is for P plus IP vortex cores is the existence of a zero energy mode in the spectrum. So what does that imply? So this implies that when E is set to zero, the annihilation operator corresponds to the creation operator. What does this mean in fields? We started with Dirac fields, and this is basically giving us a reality constraint for the Dirac field, and this becomes a Majorana field. It's nothing but the Majorana field. And now let us appreciate why this is a non-trivial state in this system. Think we put some disorder into the system. And as I showed you, we have an emergent particle Hall symmetry in the system. So when I shake around with this level a little bit, this level has to change as well. There always has to be a partner below zero and above zero. So this is the way to appreciate that this single level at zero energy cannot move, Because if it were to move, it would have to have a partner at minus E. So this is the most explicit visualization of topological stability in this vortex core. So no matter of how you shake around the system here, as long as you keep a finite gap here, which, by the way, scales like delta squared over EF, so it's usually very small in the system, you see that this is a notion of topological stability that explicitly can be reconciled at the level of discussions of the spectrum. And you immediately see that this is intimately connected with the existence of the Majorana field in the vortex core. And then the braiding of vortices, and this, you just have to believe me now, due to lack of time, I can't go into too much detail here. The braiding of vortices induces non-commutative rotations in the internal Hilbert space of Majorana zero modes. And let me shortly flash this slide. This is the essence of asking, can we employ these non-trivial rotations associated with the braiding of different vortex cores to employ some non-trivial quantum entanglement that is stable because it is not killed by local decoherence, because the entanglement in the system is of topological nature, so any local operator could not kill it. But if you're interested in that, we can elaborate on this further later on. Let me instead come to another field that is less established, I would say. This is just going one step further in the field of P and T broken superconductivity, which is D plus ID superconductivity. So the order parameter can look like this. So that's dx squared minus y squared plus minus I sine kx sine ky. And of course, it manifestly breaks time reversal and parity, because I, again, gives us time reversal breaking and parity. When you send kx to, when you send x to minus x, then this guy changes sign and this guy doesn't. So we have breaking of T and P, and two edge mode branches are seen in this theory. So basically, you, from a topological point of view, you can think of a double copy of a P plus IP superconductor. So before we had one edge branch for the P plus IP, now we would have two edge branches for the D plus ID superconductor. And here, we could both have the notion of quantized thermal Hall conductance and quantized spin Hall conductance. So that's a property here. And again, you recall this triangle with the Pfaffian. Unfortunately, it's not as nice here because there are more involved details to link this spin singlet state to a quantum spin Hall, to a quantum Hall spin singlet state. So there are links between this D plus ID superconductor and spin 1/2 Cairo spin liquids on the spin liquid side and spin singlet quantum Hall states on the other side. And this goes back to early papers by Ian Affleck and Phil Anderson, as well as a very, very important work by Xiao Gang and Hatsugai. Unfortunately, I don't recall the first name. So why is this, in a way, less efficient to have non-abelian physics in the superconductor? Yeah?
Wave function for the D plus ID.
Yeah. It's a bit more complicated. So the paper I would suggest reading is this paper by Wen and Hatsugai. Basically, the immediate guess would be, oh, it should be a Hall-Henry-Zeiss state. But the Hall-Henry-Zeiss state, as you know, is at a critical point. So it's not. So you need to go to the recoupling phase. You need to expand into the recoupling phase to get a quantum Hall wave function analog to this D plus ID superconductor. It's a bit more involved. It's not as beautiful as the Pfaffian, which I try to avoid entering this discussion. So, but what you can easily appreciate here is that why people at the beginning didn't really think too highly of D plus ID superconductors, aside from the question of experimental realization. First statement was, namely for a long time, the statement was that there should be no non-abelian physics in the vortex course. How can we appreciate that? So the number of edge modes relates to the low energy number of Majorana fields in the problem. So we can think of that at one stage to have two Majorana modes at zero energy. But now you see that the argument can apply. But now as we put in disorder, the Majorana fields have a partner. So one of them could go below energy zero and the other one could above energy zero. So this stability that we previously had for the single isolated Majorana field in the vortex core does not apply anymore. So that was the reason why people for a long time didn't really appreciate the more detailed investigation of D plus ID superconductors. But then in a recent work by Sato, Takahashi, and Fujimoto, they claim that adding Rushbaugh coupling to the problem, as well as a rather small Zeeman field, can drive a topological phase transition in this superconductor from TK and N number 2 to 1, which is just saying that as soon as we are at 1, there should be just one isolated Majorana mode again, and this isolated Majorana mode at zero energy should again share topological stability. So the punchline of this work is, well, if we want to have topological superconductivity with non-abelian features, we do not necessarily have to look at P plus IP superconductors. We could also look at D plus ID superconductors.
So these two, like if you have a spin in this problem, are there actually four single modes here? Are there still, or is there, well, is this two connected to spin at all?
Yeah, this, well, yeah, the chiral spin liquid. Actually, like, you know, you can map one branch to be spin up and the other branch to be spin down. Yeah.
Well, I'm asking because, of course, in a spinful chiral P wave, in an ordinary vortex, you do have both a spin up and a spin down, but they do carry different quantum numbers. But of course, if you have a half quantum vortex, presumably you only have one of those.
Yeah, so things.
So I'm just wondering if this two Majorana modes is associated with, do they also carry a separate spin label that's opposite in these two modes, or are they indistinguishable from their quantum number?
I think they're indistinguishable.
Okay.
It's a spin up and a spin
down.
That's
what causes the huge problem.
Yes.
I have just a question on the meaning of D plus ID. So for P plus IP, you showed us that this gap function was linear in K, right?
Yeah.
So does this mean it's quadratic in K? Is that
what D plus IP
means, or what does it mean?
Okay, the most physical interpretation is it's fixing the relative orbital angular momentum of a Cooper pair. So when the relative orbital angular momentum of a Cooper pair is 2, then you would think of a D wave. When the relative orbital angular momentum is 1, you would think of a P wave. When the relative orbital angular momentum is 0, you would think of an S wave. And this is just manifesting in the harmonics that enter the gap function of the respective superconductor.
Right, so does that mean that the second harmonic enters the gap? It's not the second harmonic that enters the gap function?
In fact, the answer is in the previous. You had the gap function. Next.
That doesn't,
if you expand
that
it for
like
small
a,
k.
Yeah, of course. You can say kx, k, kx squared
yeah.
minus ky
plus
squared plus my I kx ky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
certainly. So now that we have a new, so this is, I think, an interesting point, which is saying that these interesting topological aspects of ruthenates that people have been considering for a while may actually be found in D plus ID superconductors as well. And let me give you the main result of our work already now, and then try to elaborate a bit more on actual material realizations of this. So the recipe for finding X plus IX superconducting order, we can relate to a fairly general statement saying the following. Think again of this pairing field that we have written here in real space now, and think of what type of symmetries this pairing field still obeys. And it obeys the irreducible point group representations of the lattice where you put the superconductor on. So think of one Cooper pair and two electrons sitting on the lattice, and then you ask about what are the symmetries of this Cooper pair wave function. And what you could come up with is, as long as the fluctuations that are affiliated with this superconducting mean field keep the lattice symmetries, this should also be manifest in the superconducting gap function. And from this notion, we can look at point group symmetries of different systems and ask, well, now that we fix some orbital angular momentum of the Cooper pair, do we map on a lattice representation that is one-dimensional or multi-dimensional? So when we do this for the square lattice, let me pick this first because this is most intuitive, then we know that there's a unity representation of C4, which is two-dimensional. And as you look into that, this is exactly linked to the P-wave superconductors. So in there, the independent solutions are Px and Py. So when you do the same study of C6 for a honeycomb lattice or for a triangular lattice, you'll see multiple other two-dimensional representations where, as you think of which is the orbital angular momentum that this representation corresponds to, is located in the D-wave sector. So as you can see, we have a natural degeneracy of px and py for the square lattice in the same way as we have a natural degeneracy of dx squared minus y squared and dxy on the honeycomb lattice and on the triangular lattice. So this gives a very important insight. This is telling us that given the system wants to form a D-wave superconductor on a honeycomb lattice or on a triangular lattice, from this perspective, it has equal propensity to form dx squared minus y squared and dxy, and this is protected by symmetry. So the natural question then to ask is, what does the system do having at hand two independent D-wave solutions? And what it does, it forms the superconducting order parameter that gives the maximum amount of condensation energy, which is exactly the bulk gap version of it, which is D plus ID or P plus IP. So that's the mechanism we have in mind. It's a generic mechanism stating that due to representation theory, you can argue that an electronically driven superconductivity on a honeycomb lattice or on a triangular lattice is triggering D plus ID superconductivity naturally.
Right, because you know, for example, in the tetragonal case, you can get a fully gapped.
Sure, but you see, for that, I removed this discussion of spin because in this case, for example, here I would be assuming that they're perfectly locked into the singlet. I'm not even considering excitations out of the singlet sector, and here I would assume that they are perfectly locked in the triplet sector. So I wouldn't even be considering fluctuations in the singlet sector.
Okay, but it's just that there are triplet states that are fully gapped.
Yeah, I fully agree. I fully agree. But this is the main message of our research, basically, in the last months. So this is what we realized when we did our calculations. And this will set the path, to our point of view, to get a stronger experimental incentive to study honeycomb and triangular systems which may give rise to electronically driven superconductivity. That's the message of the talk, basically. So now, let me elaborate a bit more on this. So that's what I said here, and we want to achieve a setup in which the the spin fluctuations give rise to the superconducting phase that I just elaborated on being of D plus ID type. For example, here. And so what we need is take a triangular honeycomb lattice or a honeycomb lattice, then find some Fermi surface that looks sort of well behaved. There are, of course, details to figure out. Then achieve an electronically driven pairing mechanism, which is mostly due to spin fluctuations. And then dope the system away from the such that you don't have a magnetic instability, and then you would naturally expect a superconducting instability to arise. So that's sort of the recipe that we have in mind for doing so. And the methods that I'm going to introduce is functional RG, but because we invested so much time to getting into the basic concept of what the approach of our work is, let me just shortly say what we get out of this. So I'm happy to discuss with anyone on the details of the method, but let me wrap it up saying that what we get is the gap function. So basically, the outcome of this is the input is an ab initio description of the system. We take an RG approach to obtain the low-lying superconducting instability in the system. And for the superconducting instability, we get a very precise description of the superconducting gap function, which we could in turn use for additional onset mean fields treatments of this superconducting phase facing this or that superconducting order parameter. And the way we do this numerically is we're discretizing different patches in the Brillouin zone, so we discretize. If this is a Fermi pocket. So what we do is we discretize this pocket into different patches of the Brillouin zone, and then basically treat these different patches as individual representatives for the whole patch. So there are details involved, but the takeaway message on zeroth order is that what we obtain at the end of the day is the superconducting gap function. And there have been recent efforts to extend this RG approach to multi-orbital systems, mainly done in Dong Hailey's group and work by Fa Wang, and also by our group lately. And we mainly started looking at the nictites, but now people start considering this method for other fields of superconductivity.
Yeah. interchangeably, but is it honeycomb with two atom bases, or is it a regular hexagonal?
So for the arguments that I was giving you, all I need is C6. So when I sit on the triangle, it is, the C6 is basically redundantly the same as for the honeycomb. That is all I'm saying. So either I'm sitting in the center of a honeycomb, or I'm sitting on the point of a triangle.
So it would work for graphene as well?
Yeah, so as I announced, we looked at graphene being a representative of a honeycomb lattice, and we looked at cobaltates being a representative of the triangle lattice. But unfortunately, I just realized that introducing these conceptual aspects, I'm actually pretty tight on time, so let me keep this aside. This is just another methodological accomplishment that we did lately, basically trying to generalize these RG approaches to anisotropic spin systems. And I'm welcome to talk to anyone about it. I think it's an interesting path to access frustrated magnetism as well, but this was supposed to be a parenthesis anyways. So let me shortly, unfortunately just shortly, flash the results, but let me not go through this too quickly without saying that actually in both the systems, both in graphene and in cobaltates, Baskeran has been the one of the leading theorists realizing at the earliest stage what the unconventional superconductivity is in the systems. So this applies to both systems that I will present. This is both graphene. This dates back to first statements by Baskeran in 2002, and that was caught up by, I forgot to mention Sabdoniak here, by Sabdoniak and Gonzalez, and lately now by our group, by Rahul Nandkishore, Levitov, and Shubokov, as well as Dong Haili's group in Berkeley. And why people were now interested in graphene and to potentially host superconductivity is the fact that now apparently Alan Rotenberg has accomplished a way to dope the system in such a way that he doesn't introduce that large amount of disorder. How does he accomplish this? He's using, there are different ways, but let me just explain one way. One way is to potassium dope graphene and to put potassium on top of the graphene layer in such a way that the potassium itself forms a superlattice. In forming a superlattice, the induced disorder from the disorder induced from the potassium is not large. So their statement is that you can get nice doping levels in graphene without killing potential many body phases due to the presence of too strong disorder. And that was basically Max's one of Max's PhD works. Okay, so what can we do with graphene doped to high fillings? If you look at the band structure of graphene, don't get irritated by red and black. If I had more time, I would tell you about different kinetic theories for graphene. But for the point that I want to make here is, you see that as we dope graphene, we can reach a point where the von Hove singularity is reached. And as a consequence out of this, from a weakly coupled perspective, you would get an enlarged density of states, and due to that, an enlarged emergence of many-body phenomena. And around this, the Fermi surface looks a bit like this. So it's basically, again, a hexagon within the Briançon hexagon. And as you can see here, from a weak coupling perspective, who is interested in this, this is a partially nested Fermi surface. So these parts are nested, these are nested, and these are nested. And this is already telling you that you can get nice hexagonal spin fluctuations in the problem. But the main result of ours is the phase diagram as a function of filling. So this is the von Hove filling. And what we find is, in our RG approach, that the system, depending on other details that I can't go into now, either forms an SDW around von Hove or a D plus ID superconductor, which is, of course, what we're most interested in. But let me tell you that this helical magnet would also be extremely interesting. But the D plus ID, we believe, and this lambda C is the critical scale, so we can't give absolute estimates, but we can say at von Hove, it is larger, it is enhanced by a factor of 4 or 5. So we can give relative statements of TC, we can't give absolute statements of TC. And we get a D plus ID superconductor here, and that of course would be interesting to observe. Let me make it most explicit again what I meant by the system forming a bulk gap. So when we do our RG analysis, these are two superconducting gap functions that we get out. And both of them are degenerate. So in the flow, the propensity of the system to form one of the two D-wave solutions is degenerate. So what the system then does is, if we were individually looking at the gap function here, you see the presence of the nodes in both solutions of D-wave. But now, when you form a D plus ID, you can get a superconducting gap. And by superconducting gap, I mean the experimental gap. So you detect the superconductor and see whether there's an excitation gap in this thing. And you see that it becomes rather homogeneous. And this makes it explicit why the system may want to form D plus ID. In doing so, it gains condensation energy by forming a clean bulk gap. And that's the message here. On the cobaltates, this is ongoing work. We have also been looking at this superconducting phase in the cobaltates. And this was found experimentally in 2003. And I think 2 or 3 months later was commented on by Baskaran to be D plus ID from an RVB picture. But what is interesting, these cobaltates are amazing. It's so many different interesting quantum many-body phases. But I'm just mentioning the superconducting phase here at the moment. Our studies, which are to be published in the next weeks, resolve an experimental controversy related to the fact that the superconductor should be a singlet superconductor, but at the same time seems to show nodal tendencies. I'm just saying that our approach applied to this problem gives a resolution to this puzzle, and what we see as the main result, let me show you here. So this is sort of the doping of the material, where you see this D plus, where you see the superconducting phase. And when we look at the gap function, the physical experimental gap function along the Fermi surface, we would see strong gaps along the corners here, but along the edges, very small gaps. So we see a strong anisotropy of the D plus ID form, of the D plus ID form factor or gap function for the cobaltates, and we believe this can reconcile the experimental evidence available, both being a singlet superconductor, but at the same time having parts of the Fermi surface that are only weakly gapped. Okay, so let me summarize. So the detailed knowledge about the topological phase, I think, helps to design a material investigation plan for topological superconductors, which you've seen here, right? We understood that fixing D plus ID from a symmetry perspective gives us an angle to make proposals to experimentalists and ask, so what range of materials should you be able to access? And given that they all work out from your perspective, which may be interesting to look into? So I would really say that honeycomb superconductors, electronic to driven honeycomb superconductors, are the most promising ones. And aside from chiral triplet superconductivity, chiral singlet superconductivity can show us non-Hibbian statistics. That was the same message of this talk. And we predict D plus ID superconductivity and details of the experimental implications of it, both for graphene doped to von Hove and water intercalated cobaltates. And in total, I think from a more general perspective, I hope I could convince you from the statement that exotic singlet superconductivity maybe promises realization in a large class of materials and promise new discoveries of topological superconductors in the soon future. Thanks a lot.
Are there any questions?
If you compare your study with other intermediate and strong coupling study, for example, quantum Monte Carlo or other methods, how far you can take up your weak coupling? How high can you go? Can you reach intermediate coupling?
It's hard to make a rigorous statement on this. In principle, if I were giving you an answer that Steve Kivelson probably would adopt, so they have a great analytic approach to similar problems. And they say they would call weak coupling the case where the ratio between interaction and bandwidth is epsilon large. So it's very, very small.
This is really weak coupling.
This would be really weak coupling. But there, as you well aware of, the only instability that you can possibly get is this Cooper instability-driven superconductivity. So the only generic instability that you would see there is superconductivity. So when you allow for finite ratios, the price you pay is it is not rigorous anymore because you're neglecting diagrams that, at least on a marginal scale, may change the physics. But at the same time, it gives you access to a competition between different channels. It gives you a competition between the particle hole channel, which can host magnetic instabilities, charge density wave instabilities, and the superconducting channel. And I think the semi-rigorous statement here is that as long as you are located in a ratio of interactions and bandwidth where this ratio is of the order of one or smaller, at least our present experience is telling us that we can obtain a very good description of the materials.
I have a very simple question. So finally, what you were doing was spin fluctuation analysis in the weak coupling limit, right? Mm. So I guess my question is, maybe that's not what you were doing, but
no.
My question is, why did you need RG? Because if you were looking at spin fluctuations, couldn't you just do BCS, weak coupling theory, or
yeah.
What did you gain by doing the RG?
So what you gain is you include all ordering tendencies of the system on equal footing.
So
what you do is you have an ab initio approach. You're not biasing the system towards superconductivity. And you get a completely unbiased RG description of all the fluctuations that are electronically driven.
And in that, you did see this D plus ID become like the
yes.
largest ID.
Yes,
value.
It's okay. A much stronger statement than all these RPA statements and whatever. So because it's a microscopic approach that does not bias the system to form the superconductor. And in doing so, for example, say the nictides, where you have an intricate interplay between spin fluctuations and magnetic phases and superconducting phases, I believe this is by far the most solid weak to intermediately coupled approach to accomplish for that. And because you're an expert on all this, let me give you a detailed argument that may not be. So here, what you see here is all these diagrams, all these Paquette diagrams, we incorporate at any infinitesimal slice of a momentum. So if you do RPA and you're saying, okay, I want to see a superconductor, you go to the particle channel and just keep this and just do some geometric series of that. If you want to look at a magnetic instability, you just keep the Pyrox channel and remove everything else. We keep all the vertex corrections at the Paquette level in a completely unbiased fashion. And that's the main strength of this method. It doesn't give preference to any instability. So when this method finds an instability, it's a profound statement that this system should get this.
You still truncate at some point.
We truncate the higher order diagrams entering this resummation.
Right.
That is true.
And there's no small parameter which...
Yeah, and we hope to have a small parameter which is given by the interaction over bandwidth. Because as you can see, these Paquette diagrams scale like U squared. And when you think of the internal momentum integrals, this gives you the other scale. So it's sort of like U squared over bandwidth squared. So as long as this parameter is small, you can say, okay, we just keep the Paquette equations, the Paquette diagrams
right.
up to leading order. And this would be one loop, one part of irreducible diagrams.
More questions?
I missed something really simple or basic. Where is the topological order in what you showed us about the superconductor?
Okay, so the topological order does not show up in the superconductor itself, but the D plus ID superconductor, as I tried to elaborate before, gives a background in which topological order emerges. And let me make this clear at this point. So, as I told you, a D plus ID superconductor should have a bulk gap. Now again, do a measurement, do a transport measurement at energy scales below this gap. Then you should still see edge modes in the system. And these edge modes are stable. So these edge modes, you can't remove them. They are topologically protected as a consequence of this superconducting phase that you are in.
But I agree with you that the superconductor itself doesn't host these topological aspects, but it gives a background in which they emerge. So the edge theory of the superconductor has these edge nodes that you would link to topological non-trivial systems. So the experimental quantity is very related to a quantum Hall system where you would immediately agree that this is topologically ordered. So it's.
So how do we see that the edge mode has to have, how do we see that there are these topologically protected edge modes?
Basically what you would do is you would do a field, so maybe the most accessible description from your perspective is probably some field theory description of the superconductor. So then you would go to the long wavelength limit, you would have neutral particles, as we just elaborated, the charges get screened at long wavelengths. So then you would see that the edge theory that you're describing has two Majorana branches. And then you would ask, okay, so in the presence of a bulk gap, then you can ask, can we kill these edge nodes by some local operator? Then you would compute the expectation value of this local operator. So you would ask, can we remove this low energy branch? Can we remove this branch that is connecting the vacuum of the superconductor with the other excited states above the bulk gap? So this will be just an edge mode. And this edge mode, we can ask, can we remove it? And then the answer will be, no, we can't remove it, given that we do not spoil the mechanism that is responsible for forming this D plus IV superconductor. But I mean, the easiest thing, I mean, look, for P plus IP, I can give you probably more accessible statements there. Since we know it's a Pfaffian wave function, we can talk about the 5/2 state without any problem. And then you would appreciate it already at the level of a quantum Hall system, which may be more appreciable for you from the. So the edge theory of the quantum Hall systems completely linked to the edge theory of these superconductors. So from the edge theory perspective, they're completely related.
Related, but you talked several times about quantized thermal Hall conductance. Now, usually that sounds like a strange combination of words, right? I mean, quantized and thermal. So thermal suggests something disorder. First of all, is it clear what it, I'm not sure what it means. Does it mean that there's some quantization in the conductivity?
Well,
if you have heat flowing,
yeah.
You get a temperature gradient transverse. Is
so
that
when,
the meaning of the
So when we look at the spectrum, so this would be the vacuum, okay? Then you have some excited states, and this is the gap. This is the bulk gap, okay, that we talked about.
Yeah.
So then we would have an edge mode here. And then no matter where you are here, the charge the channels that contribute to the conductivity, this is just one single mode. Well, of course, you're saying usually thermal conductivity, because when you don't just have a single mode, then it would involve a continuum of modes. So by varying T, there should be a continuous variation of the conductivity. But when you have everything get out except of one single channel, then this channel would always contribute because it is populated. It is manifestly populated. So as long as you reduce the temperature below the scales of the bulk gap, you should assume that no other mode is excited. And you can just get the reminiscence of this edge mode present.
So it's a very low temperature problem.
It's very low. But, so does thermal, does it just mean energy transport? What is thermal?
Look, so
exactly mean.
In a superconductor, we can only do thermal Hall measurements. If you do, you see, for a quantum Hall system, you would be talking both about thermal Hall conductivity and conventional Hall conductivity, right? But you basically don't want to, you want to avoid to access the superconductor, because the superconductor is screening the charge. So there's only one way to access it, which would be thermal Hall conductivity, which is why the emphasis is there. So the answer, why I'm saying here thermal Hall conductance, is just comes from the fact that we can do a normal charge Hall measurement on a superconductor.
Okay, but just what's the actual measurement you would do to measure the thermal, to detect the thermal quantum Hall conductivity?
Just
idealize, it doesn't have to be.
Well, so you apply a magnetic field.
Yes.
And then you basically ask, as a function of, so the different ways. So one is you can put it in a. So what was the most efficient one here?
So you're applying a temperature gradient, right, rather than I mean, I guess you're probably more used to the electrical Hall conductivity where
sure,
you apply
sure.
a
I mean, I can imagine
voltage.
What those words might mean.
I mean, here it's
mean,
very
just
similar.
To...
It's just you're applying a temperature gradient.
Yeah, it's the question which gradient you apply. But I'm a bit worried about how the experiment works exactly, so I would have to
well, I think it's
rethink
just,
again.
I mean, isn't it just you know that you've got your magnetic field and the temperature gradient are orthogonal, and you're looking at a response that's orthogonal to each of those, right?
So my question is, what's the response? So in the normal case, it's a flow of current. I mean, there's a relation between a current and a transverse
voltage.
Potential drop,
yeah.
voltage.
Yeah.
Right.
What? So the voltage could be like a temperature gradient.
Gradient.
Yes.
The voltage.
And what is the
you just get a voltage
analog?
Again,
yes. Yes,
you
get
apply
a, voltage.
A temperature gradient, you get a voltage in the perpendicular direction.
Exactly.
Yeah. So there's the conductivity tensor connecting a temperature gradient and the current.
And the current, I see. So it's not thermal. So there's nothing.
So it's like J equals.
It's not thermal in the sense that heat is flowing.
This is thermal.
No, heat
this
is
thing that's flowing is not.
Heat is flowing.
Yeah.
This is all flowing.
This is a temperature gradient.
Heat is flowing in the same way as
instead of
current.
Instead of a, yeah.
In fact, we can ask an experiment.
But the current that you're detecting,
he measures it.
He measures it.
Yeah. So you have a thermal gradient, which has a thermal current along the sample, for example, and you have a magnetic field perpendicular to that.
Yeah.
Then you also get a temperature gradient perpendicular to both of those, to the heat current and the temperature.
Do you get a voltage
right,
as
do you
well?
Measure?
Well, you might do, but not in a superconductor.
Yeah.
Do you measure the heat flow? Is that what you measure, or do you measure just the current of
just the temperature difference?
Temperature.
But the current that you're measuring, the
no,
flow is what?
Well, I guess you would get a flow in that direction.
No,
too.
No, but a lot said the
because
sample
you have a temperature gradient, but there's no source and sink, right? So you can't have an actual flow, but it will set up a temperature gradient. Of course.
So you're nothing is flowing.
No, nothing flows transverse.
No, but longitudinally.
Things yeah, things flow longitudinally.
That's,
flow
and is that what you measure?
No. Well, that's
you
measure your heat current.
Yeah.
You're driving.
That's where you measure the power you put in to generate a longitudinal temperature gradient.
Right.
But you're measuring the transverse part, which will only appear when you apply magnetic field.
Yes.
Because
well,
you're electric.
And you actually see plateaus in this? Well.
I guess so. I don't know. I'm
well, just one value, I think.
Is
the
thermal conductance quantized? Is it measured to be quantized?
I don't know. I'm not so
well,
familiar.
Well, first you'd have to discover a topological superconductor, right?
Oh, okay. So you said there isn't an example.
No. Well, I don't know what happens in the quantum hall, whether there's anything in there.
Well,
you know, there
I mean, normally it's associated with maybe unpaired electrons.
Okay, but still there is still a condensate,
quantum.
And the condensate carries...
No, that's right. Correct.
So how would you apply even a thermal equation?
Well, I mean, you always have phonons, but that's another matter. So, I mean, what's the...
I know how to apply a temperature gradient. Partial T, partial X.
Yeah, will it sustain it?
Yeah.
Okay, so we have one more question.
Well, I hope my question will be shorter. So I know there are some like organic compound, KBTT, you know, they are triangular lattice and they have superconducting family compounds. So do you have any comments on that with plus ID?
So basically, in most of the systems, at least a large part of the community would say that organic superconductors are driven by phonons. So when they are phonon driven, then since a phonon spectrum has signatures in frequency and no signatures in K, right, the natural symmetry of the superconducting order parameter would be S wave. As opposed to that, an electronically driven superconductor has signatures in K. Right? So the matrix element entering the BCS treatment would be K dependent. So my answer is, I think that would be interesting, given that we could prove that the superconductivity is of electronically driven origin. But this is ongoing discussion in this field.
I think the majority of the people believe it's electronic.
Yeah. I mean, these probability results are believed to be very electronic and D-wave.
Yeah, if so, they would definitely fall into that class.
More questions?
You mentioned about the small spin-orbit coupling and the Zeeman field trapping a Majorana mode. So that means there is a quantum phase transition from a non-topological to a topological state.
Yeah.
So has that been investigated?
Well, yeah. There's this single paper by this Japanese group, and it's still to be considered. It's still a mean-free treatment. It has not yet resonated with the community. But of course, I liked it a lot because it gives an interesting motivation to look into that D plus ID,
sure,
even from a topological perspective.
More questions? Okay, so let's thank you.